Welcome to Watch It's Pod, and our guest for this episode is Steve Prest. In part two, Steve provides some truly fascinating analysis and commentary on various hybrid Navy concepts. He outlines areas where detailed thinking needs to be done to make it into a future fighting fleet capable of defending Britain properly and playing a role in NATO. I think it's well worth a listen by all UK defence decision makers, including those in government and the Royal Navy. There comes a time when somebody has to go ashore. And I suppose for you, was it when you segued or were appointed to being the a key player in the Type 31 and being the first fleet robotics officer, which sounds very almost like RoboCop.
So So two slightly separate roles. So the fleet robotics officer job, I was actually appointed into what was then called MARCAP, was forerunner of Navy Develop, Navy Dev as it's now called. And no doubt will change its name again shortly. But that was following my time in Advanced Command and Staff Course. So I'd been in WEOM Westminster, gone to Staff Course, been promoted, and went into the sort of future Navy area as the combat system sponsor for surface combatants for our surface warships. So I owned electronic warfare, radars, that kind of thing, and the combat systems themselves for the surface fleet in terms of that through life capability sponsorship. And George Zambellis, who's the first Sea Lord at the time, had this real bee in his bonnet, I think quite rightly, about that the future of the Navy was and the future of naval warfare was in large part going to be determined by autonomous systems and robotic systems in the maritime. And he said, we need to get after this. I, from a cast of one, I think, was chosen to, the absence of anyone better, was chosen to lead that push. And so we had to have a little jiggle around of responsibilities. And I rather self-styled myself as the fleet robotics officer. And I remember having a conversation with one of the, with, I think it was sort of Commodore Warfare or whatever it was called at the time. And he said, he gave me a sort of beady stare. I was a commander at the time. He said, I've just been through the list of fleet warfare officers and I don't recall there being a fleet robotics officer on that list. I said, oh, no, sir. Well, I'm not a fleet warfare officer. I'm a fleet technology officer. And he just sort of narrowed his eyes and peered at me and went,
So is it still there, though, the fleet robotics officer job, or has somebody conspired to get it deleted?
No, I don't think it's not been deleted, but it has evolved. So it survived me for a few turns of the handle, and some really good people went in there. But ultimately, it kind of got absorbed into what was Navy X and is now DCTO. So that experimentation, and we started by organizing back in 2016 something called Unmanned Warrior. You might remember it. I'm sure the magazine reported on it at the time. And I handed over to a guy called Pete Pipkin. So I did a year's worth of planning and pulling all that together and architecting it. And then Pete, as the saying went, got to deliver on my promises. And quite rightly got an ABE for doing so. And I suppose the thing about that is, you know, we're now 10 years on from Unmanned Warrior. And of course now, the transformation of the Navy through autonomous and robotic systems is now mainstream. And we were into it before it was cool. So I'm really supportive of that as an overall direction of travel. I'm an absolute believer that we've got to harness these technologies, and use them to drive the Navy forward. I think there's a conversation about how we do that and what it takes. And having done some really detailed thinking about what it will take to make that work, I think that's the conversation we need to have, as a service and as a maritime naval community. But so that was what I was doing as fleet robotics officer. I then went off to Queen Elizabeth from there, came back, and that's when I went in to be the ship's acquisition deputy director or whatever the job was called at the time. And as part of that, I was the program director for Type 31. So I joined there just after the program had been kicked off in earnest in the autumn of 2017. And I was with that program for a couple of years through main approvals and through to contract signing in 2019. And then the place was reorganized and I was given a slightly different portfolio to lead, which included the mine hunting capability program. So back to robot boats and robot submarines. and back to electronic warfare and tactical data links and perhaps more traditional sort of WE type stuff.
Looking at the hybrid Navy, which is big news as part of the defence investment plan, and your involvement, you know, early days and all the rest of it. It is something that obviously all navies have to do. You know, it's the way forward. That's clear to everyone. But is it a case that in the UK, what's happening is the lack of money or the willingness of the government to sacrifice other areas of public spending? Is it the case that more than other navies, which are also doing the autonomous thing too, they have to, they know they have to, that in the UK it's been driven by cost, and it's always dangerous to give politicians, particularly in the Treasury, a means to save money or appear to save money when conceived anyway. Is it an example of cost driving it at the expense of what are being called legacy warfare platforms or whatever? Is that what it is? Is it cost over everything in the UK when it should be? And you're talking about balance, when there needs to be more of a balance between, you know, the Type 31, Type 26, and the new drone Navy, as it were.
So I think my answer to that would be it's complicated, and I wouldn't quite characterise it in that way. I don't see this as a politicians and the bean counters versus the Navy. That's not the dynamic at play here. So. What the First Sea Lord has said, and I think he's right, is that the strategy we had was undeliverable because we didn't have the money, true, but we were never going to have the money. So planning to deliver a strategy where you haven't got and are not likely to have the resources to deliver it, it isn't a strategy, it's fantasy. You've got to make the numbers add up. I remember having a conversation with Tony Radakin when he was just about to become the First Sea Lord, and it was the end of 2018 going into 2019 from memory, and he'd given his end of term address in December at Christmas, and it was basically his manifesto for when he became First Sea Lord and how he's going to do Navy transformation. And he called me and another captain, as we were at the time, in fact the guy who'd been the commanding officer of Westminster when we went to Libya, as it happened. In the passageway, we were sort of lurking around having a chat. And he said, two wise old captains. What do you make of it? And I said, well, sir, the thing is, I think the vision you've got of the future Navy is right. You know, it's a Navy not only I want to be part of, but I want to be part of creating. And I think the things you want to do to get us there are, they're the right things, broadly speaking. So, you know. But the challenge you're going to have is you've got to make the numbers add up. And the three things that you've got to get right, you've got to have enough money of the right type in the right years with the authority to spend it. You've got to have the workforce, i.e. the people in uniform, to crew the capabilities as they're coming into service. So, you know, that translates now into we've got to be crewing up 31, we've got to be crewing up 26. We've got, you know, and I've got a couple of other stories around that to illustrate if you want. And I said, you've also got to balance the capacity of the enterprise to deliver the volume of change that you're asking for. So, yes, that's this headquarters. It's also DNS. It's also defense infrastructure. It's also defense digital and the supporting industrial base. And if we can get all of those things lined up, then we're in with a chance of making this work. And I remember at the time, and I like Tony Radakin a lot. I've got a huge amount of respect for him. But he said to me, don't worry about any of that, Steve. The numbers are all made up anyway. We just need to get on with it. Think and do different. I remember thinking, I'm not sure that's right. And what it turned out is that we got then to General Jenkins doing his analysis. And of course, his analysis, and he said this publicly, is we haven't got the time, the money, nor the people to get ourselves in the shape we need to be in to face the emerged threat, particularly from Russia, but other actors as well. And he's right, because we didn't have a strategy the way the numbers added up. So you can say, well, someone should have given us the wherewithal to have made those numbers add up. Or you can say, well, actually, we had a responsibility to come up with a strategy that was deliverable as opposed to fantasy, you know, based on, whatever. So, and the only choice you ever get in life is what you do next. So the question for General Jenkins is coming in, you know, a year or so ago to be First Sea Lord is, what do I do next? So this is the situation I find myself in. I've been told to be ready to fight the Russians by the time I leave in 2029 or whenever. Right. Well, you know, we're not going to get vast numbers of Type 26 and Type 31 by then. They're going to start trickling in and we've got to crew them. And even if the Norwegians don't take off any, and even if we could build them twice as quickly, we couldn't crew them anyway. And we couldn't ammunition them, and so we've got to do something different. So what are we going to do? Well, let's have a look around the world and see what's working for other people. Technology, autonomy, AI, blah, blah. Okay, this looks like something that is different and probably is the best different thing that gives us the most likely chance of success. So we're going hard after that. So that's the logic. And to as far as that goes, I'd buy it. Now, does that mean we shouldn't be having a real think about what we're going to be doing at the back end of the 2030s in terms of our fleet? What's going to replace Type 45? How we get... fine. But in the meantime, what are we going to do? And just carrying on as we were, even with an increase of resource, you know, wasn't going to get us ready in the way that we need to be ready. So we have to do something different. And I'm not a cynic, but I am a skeptic, and I'm a systems thinker. So I will say something about that in a moment, if I may. But so I think we've got to do something different. So I wouldn't badge it as, Treasury just being tight-fisted. Now, over the last 30 years, have we invested enough in the Royal Navy and the infrastructure and the stockpiles for missiles going to war in Libya? You know, and? No, evidently not. But we can only make choices based on where we are today, and we've got to go forward. So we can lament the fact that the case wasn't made sufficiently compellingly enough over the last 30 years, but we've also got to get on. And there was lots in the Defence Investment Plan, and there are a number of things that, I think we could have wished for more, but there's a big investment going into our naval bases. You know, 15 years too late, you know, it's publicly reported, we've got a load of SSNs, you know, our nuclear attack submarines stuck alongside because they can't get the maintenance done. So fine, we need to do that work. It's not going to be a quick fix, but it needs to be done. Fine. So we're getting on there. As it pertains to the hybrid navy, therefore, well, we've got to do these things. The question then is, right, if we all agree the threat, if we all agree there's a real why, so we've got to get on and do stuff because, you know, look at what's happening in Russia and blah, blah. Right. Let's go on. And we all sort of broadly now agree the what, because we recognize there isn't really another alternative that, you know, moves the ball down the pitch at the speed we need to. The question then is the how. And I think that's where you have to have a debate. And if, as I'm picking up from some of my chums who are still inside, the sort of line that General Jenkins used, and I've heard it parroted by some of his more junior officers at different conferences, that, you know, I've got no time for cynics and traditionalists and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm. The problem is, if you shut down the debate about how, by saying to anybody who says you need to think a bit about the engineering and logistics and resilience and economic balance of all this, and you brand them cynics and traditionalists, and you'll stand into danger. You know, in the Chilcot report into Iraq talks about needing a culture of reasonable challenge. You know, not that we're trying to derail what you're trying to achieve or why you're trying to do it, but you've got to have a debate about what it's going to take. And I understand it's not going to be perfect from day one. You've got to iterate this, you know, in inverted commas, agile, but an iterative approach. So you've got to start small, increment fast, build big. There are caveats on that, and I can talk about that if you want me to. But if you don't think about the stuff from the start, you run a real risk of disappearing down a cul-de-sac. And that's what you can't afford to do. There's a brilliant book on my bookshelf just behind me here, Ian. And I know it's an audio-only podcast, so listeners won't necessarily see it. But there's a brilliant book called How Big Things Get Done by a guy called Bent Flubier. It looks like Flyberg, if you were to write it, but he's Danish. And I'm told by my Danish chums it's pronounced Flubier. And one of the things he says, one of his heuristics for getting big things done, he said, think slow, act fast. Because thinking and planning is cheap. So make sure you know what it is you want to do and how you're going to do it, and then do it as quickly as you can, because that's how you minimize risk. And so you make, put it another way, you, you, you maximize the chances of successful outcomes. So I think we need to have some of these conversations about the thinking up front, particularly about, you know, I mean, there's loads of people who will sell you a remote control ship. That's not the hard bit. The hard bit is, how are you going to do the logistics, the engineering sustainment, the support? How are you going to manage explosives and complex munitions and make sure they're ready for firing for the duration of the mission? And same for gunnery systems or whatever you're going to put on these things for 28 days whilst they're up in the North Atlantic without someone going up there to make sure they're greased and, you know, whatever. Those are the problems you've got to solve.
Yeah.
But if you're not prepared to think about those things in that detail, you know, the what it will take to make this work, the what are we going to do? You can wish those problems away and go, oh, well, we're just not going to bother with that. Well, okay, so you never need self-protective guns on an uncrewed ship, right? Well, yeah, no, we probably will. Well, then you need to have a think about how you're going to do it, because there's some setup you need. Whatever it is, even if it's just making sure you've got guardrails you can put up around the thing so you can get safely people on board at sea periodically to go and do what you need to do, and then they get off again. But if you don't build a platform, you stick it somewhere inaccessible and you end up having to bring it back alongside before you can do preps for firing on it, well, you're in the middle of North Atlantic for 6 weeks. That's not going to work. Or you have to run your whole fleet differently. But no, so if you've got a different plan that's better, that's great. But what is that different plan? And it's that sort of thing that I think we need to think through in a lot more detail, and I'm not sure we are. The other element then is the cognitive and what I call the cognitive architecture. Who or what is making what decision, where or when, and under what circumstances? So what decisions are being made by computers, algorithms, AI agents, whatever you call them? What decisions are being made by humans across this distributed fleet of crewed and uncrewed systems? And what happens when you lose comms link? So you've got your shooter ship out there, your effector ship, missile carrying barge, Type 91, and it loses comms with a decision making ship. Because guess what? When someone's attacking, they're going to be jamming really hard, and they're going to be trying to disrupt. And you might only lose the comms for 20 seconds, but that might be enough for a missile to come over the radar horizon and attack the ship. So is it allowed to fire without that human oversight under certain conditions? Is there a set to auto mode? How does it get a track in that environment so that it's got something, a target indication to fire at? How does it know which targets are for it? You know, in this raid of, let's say, you know, 100 drones, 50 missiles, sea-skimming missiles, and 20 ballistic missiles, you know, that's coming inbound. We've got all these arsenal ships. And how do we decide who takes what when the comms are disrupted? I don't know. But to me, if it's going to be credible for inverted commas warfighting, you've got to be able to answer those questions, and you've got to have the systems and architectures in place. So you've got this cognitive architecture of decision-making, which can be as much, you know, also at the level of navigating the ship. Who's in charge of navigating the ship? Does the ship itself make decisions about which way it goes and how it goes around other ships and avoids sandbanks or whatever? Or is there someone with a remote control, you know, sat in Portsmouth or somewhere else? And when? What happens when you want to do some sort of replenishment at sea? Who's driving it then? Is it driving itself? Is it, you know, what decisions are being made by who? Someone once said to me that a really good way of thinking about that decision-making architecture is, what branch badge do you put on the sleeve of the AI or the algorithm? So we back in the old day, we had radar operators and radar plotters, the RPs. And so you had a big radar thing, and then with a China graph, they used to draw on the screen, and you could track these radar plots, you know, a little dot, and they'd form a track. And then we had automated track extractors. Well, first we had plot extractors, then we had track extractors. And actually, we got rid of the RPs because we didn't need them, because the automated track extractor did that job for them. It was allowed to make the decision about forming a track on a repeated radar contact, and they're standard. So we got rid of them. What about the air picture compiler or surface picture compiler? Can that person be replaced? You know, kill it, say, that's the AB. And then the supervisor level, and then the director level, and then the PWO level, or the officer of the watch level. So what authority are we prepared to give these, let's call them AI agents? And under what circumstances? Does it matter if we're at peace, we're at war, we're escalating, we're de-escalating, we're navigating? So you've got to, to my mind, you've got to think all of that through. have that architecture, and it's a doctrine and concept sort of thing, how we're going to fight. And then you say, well, what information and data architecture do we need to underpin those, that thing? And then, you know, the good Rear Admiral Singleton, Director of Navy Digital, or whatever title is this week, you know, could build the system using, whether it's through the chums in Defence Digital and elsewhere, and the rest of the NAD group, to build that architecture you need to support that decision-making architecture to do that warfighting function in that contested, denied, degraded environment. I'm not seeing that conversation happening. I'm not hearing it happening. What I'm hearing is we bought some remote control boats and now we're going to build some remote control ships.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a bit, and I've said this before on the podcast, of when submarines came along and you had a lot of private enterprise, whether it was Basil Zaharoff or other people, Nordenfelt or whoever it was, or John Philip Holland, who were working away on the various components of what would eventually make a successful weapon of war, you know, a crude weapon of war, you know, the submarine, you know, whether it was the propulsion, the torpedoes, or weapon of any kind, the periscope, the petrol or diesel engine. So it only came together in the end after a lot of development, a lot of errors and mistakes. But throughout the whole process, let's say from the 1860s in the American Civil War through various other wars up until the early 20th century, there were, of course, lots of innovators, bless them, and others who were trying to make money or who were just geniuses who were coming up with all the various bits. And they would oversell it. Of course they would, because they wanted more money and more investment. So one of the fears I have, and I've said it before on here, is that we're jumping ahead in that phase to jump right into it without waiting for the 1901 moment, which was when the Royal Navy finally decided, or earlier than that, finally decided that submarines were a viable thing and that they should now get into that business. So I think what you're perhaps saying there, what you've just said, is that we're in that, let's say, 1860 to 1899 period where it's being developed and we need to think about it, what could it be used for? And only when we get to actually ordering Holland 1, which combines everything, you know, propulsion, weapon, periscope, whatever, crew, have you got the actual weapon system you can then use? And of course, they then had to work on doctrine anyway. So I think, you know, all these years on, we're in that stage. But do you also think now with social media, and you're a chap who's been in public relations for the Navy, trying to convey a complex system, the Queen Elizabeth carrier, do you think we're also in a slightly dangerous situation where people come up with AI films and CGI and want to press ahead on social media and get people's imaginations gripped, that that's outpacing sometimes? I mean, look at the, in a way, and I know I'm giving you a list of things to just quickly, you know, to chat about. Also look at HMS Stirling, the mine warfare, you know, trial ship, which I don't think it's been clear really, certainly from my point of view, that although, you know, I've realised it, some of our contributors may have expected other things of it, that vessel is a trials vessel and you need to get through the whole testing and evaluating before you move to the next phase, which would be an actual frontline vessel that's a mine warfare mothership. So are we in this kind of confusing mishmash, do you think? I think that's what you've just hinted at anyway.
Well, there's a lot in there, Ian. So yeah. Let me deal with Stirling Castle. Because I was the senior responsible owner that signed the business case to buy her. So she's a great ship. And we had a real opportunity coming off the back of COVID, where the market was suppressed, to get a really good secondhand ship at a really good price. And the team in DNS, and DNS or NAD material or whatever they're called this week, get a lot of bad press. But actually, they did a really good job under Rear Admiral Paul Carroll. The team really drove to get this deal done, you know, whilst the window of opportunity was open. And we had to do a bit of fast footwork around approvals and getting the money lined up and, but we took a real opportunity and a good outcome. Now, there have been problems with crewing through the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. The RFA is having challenges. You know, we did check at the time. I just want to reassure you, we did check. Can this be crewed? Yes, great. Let's go. You know, didn't turn out quite that way, but it's not that we didn't do the work. You know, she was brought in service. But as you say, she was there as a trials vessel. So she's a civilian. She's not, she's not to go into a high threat area. She doesn't have all the protection, the shock mounts and the shock protection, all the things you need. If you're going to put someone and people in an area which is a high threat, where you think they might take ordnance inbound, there are things you have to do to the ship to make it survivable for those people, so that you don't create, you know, the sort of snatch Land Rover type situation, which I think we'd all agree is an indefensible position to put our people in. So that's why she's not going out to the Gulf at the moment. That's why Lime Bay, I think it's Lime Bay, isn't it? But it's being used as the mothership for the MHC equipment that's getting out there. But she has been useful in getting it round to Gibraltar and transporting, and she's currently doing exercises and trials at the moment, which is exactly what she was bought for. So I think we've got a really good ship there. And we'll learn loads of lessons for her that will be pulled forward into the mine warfare motherships. I can't remember what the proper term for them now is, but they were in the dip. There was funding ascribed to them as part of the dip. So, you know, that's going forward as part of the MHC program. And I've no doubt the team will do a good job. So that was Stirling Castle. But you've got to learn that lesson. But I think this incremental approach, learning as you go, is really important. There's a terrific podcast. Now, forgive me, I'm going to recommend another podcast other than your own fine vehicle, but by a guy called Tim Harford, who writes for the Financial Times, and he writes books as the undercover economist. But he's got this podcast called Cautionary Tales, and it's a good listen each week. But the one that I think is the best and most instructive is an episode he did a few years ago about Clive Sinclair and the Sinclair C5. And he described it, I think the episode's titled The False Dawn of the Electric Car. And he said that, look, it wasn't that the idea was wrong. The sort of visionary idea of personalized electric transport wasn't the wrong idea, but the ecosystem wasn't there to make it work. Now, I mean, the C5 itself was a pretty poor design, but battery technology and the connectivity you needed to make these things work at a mass scale weren't in place. So you look around any major city now, and you've got e-bikes and e-scooters and indeed electric cars, you know, scuttling around all over the place, working brilliantly. Well, that was what Sinclair had envisaged with the C5, but it'd just gone too early because the basic technology in the ecosystem wasn't yet in place to make it work in terms of apps and smartphones and connectivity and batteries and charging infrastructure and blah, blah, blah. So the question for me is, well, how do you put that ecosystem in place? If that's the sort of evolution you want, how do you make sure that what you're buying, you know, for the Navy are Teslas, not C5s? And the answer is, and actually, if you look at, I mean, for all that Elon Musk is a pretty challenging character for his somewhat, you know, challenging political views and other things. One of the things his companies have done in their approach to changing technology and changing the marketplace for technology is that they built the ecosystem. So they built, you know, you go to someone and say, do you want to buy an electric car? And you go, the batteries aren't very good. Like they haven't got the range I need. And I never know where to charge them. And blah, blah, blah. No. We've put all these chargers in and they charge really quickly. And charging every now and then on a long journey saves you more time than having to go to a petrol station, you know, once every 10 days. So, you know, it's quicker. Oh, well, how do I know where they are? Oh, well, we've built an information architecture. Oh, okay. And it just tells you, so you don't have to think about it. We just tap it in and the tech does it for you. Oh, okay. But I mean, electric cars, they're not, no, it's better to drive. It drive, you know, it's like a performance sports car off the lights. This is not like a milk float. This is going to burn off your, all the boys in their GTIs straight off the lights. Oh, so this is cool, high performance. It's now aspirational, and all the ecosystem to deal with all the things that might make it difficult have all just been taken care of, right?
Yeah.
Brills. And same Starlink. Same. So, the lesson for me of all of that for Hybrid Navy is, right, what are all those things that are going to make it hard? And what are all, so people like me will come and think through the system and say, right, here are the things you need to think about. What I'd love to be hearing is, Steve, Steve, we've already thought about that. Here's the solution. It's in place. Look, we're building a whole, you know, EV charging jetty in Scapa Flow or whatever. Yeah, I mean, you know, mixing my metaphors and it's slightly facetious, but yeah, look, we're doing it. Oh, brilliant. I didn't know about that. Okay, what about this command and control of cognitive architecture? Oh, brilliant. Come on, we should show you how it's working because we've got a plan and we've done a battle lab and we've done all the modeling and here's our in-house, and, you know, here's our tech stack and we're building a data center. And great. It's not quite what I'm seeing at the moment. I'm worried we end up in this Clive Sinclair C5 space rather than in the Tesla space. The reason I think it's also slightly different from your analogy at the sort of end of the 1930s, 20th century is that there are other people who are using similar technologies to already deliver effects in conflict. So we're seeing in the Gulf, and we're certainly seeing in the Black Sea. But the Black Sea, we've got to make sure we learn the right lesson. So just because there are people going around delivering milk in electric milk flows doesn't mean you're ready to build a Tesla. And I do worry that the sort of strike operations, which I think are being done brilliantly, and the sea denial operations that are being done, in particularly in the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea, aren't giving you sea control. And one of the things we've seen in the last few weeks is that actually the Russians are playing the same game back the other way and have absolutely strangled the grain flows out of the Black Sea from Ukrainian ports. I saw a report just this morning, day of recording, that they'd whacked a grain carrier, not Ukrainian flagged, you know, third country flagged, but they were whacking them to effectively enforce a blockade at distance using strike and sea denial tactics. And what the Navy's aspiring to with Atlantic Bastion, with Atlantic Shield at least, Atlantic Strike is obviously based on strike, but Atlantic Shield at least is it's a sea control environment. And you probably need to do different things because for sea control, you have to be able to go there and stay there.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, Atlantic Bastion, I mean, I'm just a landlubber, a civvy. If you simplified it, that is what, sea denial or is it control and denial? And this is when they use concepts like this that, and they don't explain it maybe in a simple language that they need to do. But what do you do if the Russians stay up in their bastion and they bombard you with their long-range missiles? Is that's then Atlantic Strike? I mean, is that how it divides up, do you think, simply?
No, so and you know, forgive me, I've used some technical language that I haven't explained. So in terms of sea control, what you're saying is for a limited time and space, I want to be able to reduce the risks of me and my own forces using that area of the maritime battle space, so on, under, above, sea, littoral, to an acceptable level that my own forces can use it for whatever we want to do. So we can put our carrier strike group there and protect it. And in the case of Atlantic Bastion, which is the anti-submarine capability for the North Atlantic, it means we can operate our strategic deterrent with impunity. So it's a sea control activity. So yes, we're preventing the Russians from doing what they want to do, but it's really all about reducing the risk to our own forces, in that case, the strategic deterrent. In terms of Atlantic Shield, it's whatever we want to operate up there, carrier strike groups, amphibious task groups, you know, convoys across the Atlantic, whatever, so that we can use that water space at a tolerable level of risk and keep the bad guys away. That's sea control. Sea denial is we're just stopping them from using it. So what the Ukrainians have done is sea denial because they don't have ships operating in the. What they've done is make it too risky for the Russians to use it because they're using strike. Mission. So that's what I mean by sea denial. So it's not securing it for your own use. It's about stopping them from doing it, from using it for that. And I think Atlantic Bastion and Atlantic Strike, which is the air defense, are about sea control. They're about making sure we can use those areas of water, either for our carrier strike group, an amphibious group, or and most importantly, for our strategic missile submarines to remain protected and be able to operate with impunity. The strike is then about holding their assets, their, you know, things they care about at risk. And whether that's their Northern Fleet bases or, you know, whatever it is, I don't know. I don't know the target set, and I don't want to know. But speculatively, you could say it's about being able to strike both their ships at sea, and potentially, you know, other assets, but also hold at risk things they care about ashore. With the view that you never actually have to have that fight because everyone recognizes the costs to both sides are too high, and so you have this mutual deterrent effect. So that's the sort of strategy. And so when we think about look what Ukraine's done, you know, a country without a navy has defeated a navy, and these sorts of strap lines. Yes, but it's fighting defensive war based on denial of access to that water space. It's not using, and it's currently struggling to use, even through this sort of transit corridor for the merchant shipping, to keep the sea lanes open and exercise sea control. And to exercise sea control, I mean, Black Sea is pretty landlocked itself, but certainly in the open ocean, you have to be able to go there and stay there. Now, does that mean you have to have people? Well, we'll see. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can try and solve that problem. Hitherto, we've needed ships with sailors on them to go and do that sort of job. Technology may afford us some other opportunities, but the real challenge is how do you get to sea and stay there if you haven't got, you know, ships companies full of engineers? And in most Royal Navy warships, over half the ship's company are engineers to keep the show on the road and keep things working because stuff breaks. So you either have to engineer it such that it doesn't break and build in that resilience and redundancy and so on. Well, that stops sounding cheaper. Or you have to have a plan, you know, to manage, which means you need people maybe not on board all the time, but be able to go there and sort things out, reset the fuses and, you know, change the... And if you think you might want to do some of this maintenance at sea, because the thing you need, which has got all your air defense missiles in it, or a third of the task group stock of air defense missiles, it has now broken down. I think the argument that, well, it's cheap and cheerful, and there we can afford, and so we can afford to lose it, doesn't stack up, because it's a third of your fighting capability, and it's a, you know, get it back online ASAP. All right, so we're now going to go and do something to the diesel engine, which is going to take us 6 hours or 8 hours. Okay, well, in planning that these things might happen, we're going to have to put some engine. Well, where are those engineers come from? Which ship are they on? Where are they coming from? How do we get them on board? Maybe in bad weather. How do we keep them on board? And if they've got to be on board for 6, 8, 12 hours, how do we? Where do they live? You know, how do they look after themselves? Is there a little galley, you know, a little citadel area they can? And in terms of the work, are the spares on board? So do we kit each of these ships out, these USVs, with spares and tools, so that when people come on board, all you need is a person, and not everything else is there? Or do they have to bring all of that with them? Well, if you're bringing cylinder heads for a diesel, I don't know, say, because one of them's cracked, or, you know, something like that, we need a new barrel for the gun. Well, how are you going to manage that? There's lots of different ways you could do it, and I'm not suggesting any specific solution. My point is, you've got to think it through, because if you want to go there and stay there, you've got to make sure you've got a plan to go there and stay there and do all the things you need to do to keep a ship at sea when you haven't got the people on who would normally do the things that keep the ship at sea.
Yeah, and this is the stuff you've just talked about, and that's all very illuminating, fascinating, very good stuff you've discussed there, very, very good points. And this is surely the hard thinking and the fine detail that either loses or wins wars, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, though, for want of a nail and all that. And separating out your capability, disaggregating it across different platforms has many advantages, because it makes each individual platform less vulnerable, arguably, and the capability overall of the task group can perhaps degrade more gracefully than it being a, well, we take that ship out and, you know, it loses everything. So there's that argument. And because the argument that we don't have to put people on board, and therefore the ships can be cheaper and simpler because we don't have to do all the things that we talked about needing to do for the sort of Stirling castles of this world if you wanted to put them in a high threat environment. So you don't have to do those things, so they'll be fine. But you have introduced more degrees of freedom into the complexity problem, because you've suddenly got more moving parts, you've got more connection problems, You're going to have lots of different bearers. You've got now a data problem that you didn't quite have before. And the way you solve this with a warship is you do your planning up front and then you empower the person. So you say to the commanding officer, the air defense destroyer, that's your sector. Here's the air defense plan. That's your missile engagement zone. These are the fighter engagement zones, blah, blah. If it comes down that sector, it's yours. You take it. And then if they lose all comms and all connectivity with other units, in the absence of other orders, if the raid comes in, they take what's in their sector. I mean, I'm simplifying, but how do you do that in the hybrid Navy? And this comes back to my cognitive architecture about decision-making and empowerment. And if you don't have the picture on board, your ship, because you're the missile firer, or if you're, you know, you in inverted commas, the AI agent of the sensor ship, you know, you've got the big powerful radar on, so you can see it all coming, but your comms are disrupted, so you've got a missile firer sat there. How's that going to work in the event of? Now, you can say, we're going to have a foolproof, absolutely foolproof, never offline, assured communications pathway that will never be broken between the sensor platforms, the missile platforms, and the command and control platform. So it's always going to be there. Don't worry about it. It's fine. I think it was Douglas Adams, one of our great authors, and I think one of our underrated philosophers, who said something like, the problem with something that's designed to never go wrong is that when it does go wrong, it's really, really hard to fix. And it was either him or Terry Pratchett, and I can't remember which one. Terry Pratchett, again, one of our greatest underrated philosophers in my view. He said the problem is we're stuck with technology when all we want is stuff that works. And there's a real danger in moving forward if you don't get the ecosystem right and you don't get the things in place and you don't move to the next adjacent possible and you try and take both feet off the ground and leap into the great unknown. Now, you can move to adjacent possibles really quickly if you're focused and your investment's right and create the ecosystem. So the real danger is you end up with technology when all you want is stuff that works.
So in essence, engineers in particular, but you know, sailors, marines, whoever, service personnel will be needed whatever happens within this new dawn of the hybrid Navy. Certainly they will. And we can't necessarily foresee what the new roles are for these young people and how do you get them trained up for it, and then how do you get them to sea with the knowledge they need to survive and work at sea? That's coming, isn't it? That's something that must not be forgotten in all this.
Yeah, I think the shape of our people, if you like, and the skills they're going to need are going to be really different. And if we aspire to an ecosystem which iterates the capability a lot more quickly, and the examples often given here are Ukraine in terms of how quickly you upgrade, you know, in inverted commas, the drones and so on. But Israel do this very well also. What you do is you put the technologists alongside the users, and you allow them the freedom to update things as they go. And we could and perhaps should create that sort of ecosystem, but it looks very different to the industrial base we've got now and the relationships we have. And it probably means putting people who can and are empowered to change the coding of some of this stuff in uniform, whether as sponsored reserves or whatever, alongside the operators. The challenge you have then is maintaining configuration control. How do you know what state it's at? Now, if you're in the condition the Ukrainians are in, where you know you build it and your local command is responsible for procuring their own drones, and they bring people in Ukraine, there's a little ecosystem which is effectively, it doesn't really matter to you if it's different from the one that's 100 miles down the road. Now, if you've got something really good, you might, and you've got enough, you might say, look, we've got something really good here. Do you want to? But it doesn't necessarily have to be a top down, you know, signed off safety cases, because you're prepared to take the risk, frankly. In a peacetime organization where we're not in a consumptive economy, because you build it, you throw it at the Russians. If it doesn't work, you tweak it, you throw it at the Russians, you keep going like that. If we're in the business, though, of saying, well, we're not throwing anything at the Russians at the moment, So we're just going to go and order 100,000 of them. And then we've ordered 100,000, but we want to update them every 6 weeks. What do we do? Do we order another 100,000? Well, if we get 100,000 of these things every 6 weeks, what are we going to do with them? You know, well, maybe we could just gift them to Ukraine. But what about when the fighting stops there? How do you continually test them in the same way? How do you have that ecosystem of continual upgrade? And if you've got a stockpile somewhere of 100,000 drones, there's suddenly an overhead with that. Yeah, who makes sure the battery's still charged and are conditioned and replaces them every 6 months or whatever? And who's doing the software patching? And how many of them do you use in what environment? Now, you can create this ecosystem where you're going and testing them and trying as hard as you can to defeat them, you know, using intelligence feeds from wherever. And then you go, right, now we need to go and upgrade the 90,000 we got left and order 20,000 more. And, you know, we're going to consume 10,000 a month just on trials and testing and iterating because, fine, I don't see that ecosystem existing at the moment. Now, maybe that's what we're creating, but that's the logic. If not, you're back to it's about management of scarcity, it's about allocation of resources, and it's about then management of stockpiles. And by the way, we better know which build state each one is, because when we come to change the battery, we're going to have some sort of servicing record. And right, and if it's got energetics and electrics, we're going to have to make sure it's not going to blow up in anyone's face and take the rest of the magazine out with it. It's a different kind of game. And we need to get our heads around what that means in this deterrent posture versus the consumption posture that the Ukrainian economy's in and arguably the Israelis as well, you know, who've got a slight, you know, different challenge, a different ecosystem. But what does the UK ecosystem for that look like? And that's a much broader conversation. And that's why we've got a National Armaments Director, frankly, to take charge of all of those things. But managing those stockpiles and iterating them collectively with the warfare centers who are working out, you know, and having the money and the resources to do this continual update to maintain a deterrence posture, I think is a big part of that game.
It all sounds very complex and quite daunting, but I mean, we've mastered things before. You know, the Royal Navy has, the UK has, so hopefully the right decisions will be made and people will listen to people like yourself who have got some very interesting things to say and some wise words. So, Steve, I think we'll wrap it up there. I know there's much more to talk about, but thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Warships Pod. For more food for thought from the Warships IFR magazine menu, please do check out the September 2026 edition, which comes out on the 21st of August. On the menu is a Submarine in Focus series of articles, a look at Spain's Atlantic leadership in NATO, an exercise Unitas preview. Other tasty items include a photo essay on President Putin's luxury rescue vessel, which is an unusual ship that has been assigned to Moscow's Northern Fleet, and also whether or not the Iran and Ukraine wars are merging. And if all that isn't enough to keep you satisfied and nice and full with all your naval news, analysis and commentary, there's also something on how the US Navy needs more bangs for bucks. Plenty to get your teeth into and available in shops, direct from the publisher as a hard copy edition and digitally. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.